I think we'll get started. Well, I'm Edward McCord. I'm the director of the Seeger Center for Asian Studies and also the director of the Taiwan program here at GW. We're extremely pleased today to welcome the former Vice President of Taiwan, Annette Lu, to George Washington University, former Vice President from the year 2000 to 2008. But of course, I think it's not sufficient to say that her career is defined by her vice presidency. She's been an activist most of her life. Starting in the 1970s, after she received her law degree from National Taiwan University, she became a leading figure in Taiwan's early feminist movement. She also became involved in that same period with the Dong Wai, the non-party opposition movement that was trying to strive for the elimination of single-party authoritarian rule in Taiwan and its replacement with democracy. And it's kind of in that role that she also gained national spotlight when she was arrested following a speech she gave at a rally on Human Rights Day in Kaohsiung, which became known as the Kaohsiung Incident after there was an attempted police suppression of the rally that turned into something like a police riot, I guess you would say. Anyway, she was then arrested and sentenced to prison and became something of a well-known person simply as a prisoner of conscience for many years, so not just in Taiwan but also internationally. She was finally released in 1985 due to some of the pressure on the Taiwan government from public opinion, and it's continued to be very active with the newly founded Democratic Progressive Party, and in that position also went on to become elected to the Legislative Yuan, and then after that as a county magistrate, and then finally in the year 2000 as vice president. So she's had a long political career, and she hasn't stopped. After the end of her vice presidency, she continues to be active in trying to promote Taiwan's position in international space. She's and lots of other issues in terms of women's issues, environmental issues, so she keeps very active. So again, I'm very pleased to welcome Madam Annette Lu to our campus, and I'll now turn the podium over to you. We will have questions at the end of her talk, and I want to say one thing first. When we do have questions, we want to use the microphones, and all you have to do is press the green button on the microphone to speak, and we'll be okay.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Professor Edward McCord, thank you for hosting this morning's conference. And Ms. Barbara Strait from AIT, so nice to see you again. And Ambassador McDonough, welcome. My dear friend, distinguished guest, ladies and gentlemen, I'm glad that the rain does not stop you from coming here. Today I'd like to raise the two main points, plus a brief mention about Korea Peninsula. We all face the Pacific. How can we work together to safeguard democracy, peace, and prosperity is our common responsibility. The Pacific Ocean encompasses approximately one-third of the Earth's surface, 40% of world population, two-thirds of world fish cage, and over 90% of ocean-related products all come from this region. With 30 countries having more than half of world economy, the Pacific Ocean is considered to be 21st century's new high ground. The security, stability, and prosperity of this region are the key to the entire world. However, the Pacific Ocean is by no means peaceful. Throughout the entire World War II, a total of 84 countries and 2 billion people were involved in war effort, resulting in 12 million military and 45 million civilian deaths. Of the total casualties, 35 million were in the Pacific theater. In this century, 21st, the Asia-Pacific region is facing other problems. There are over 2 billion people living in more than 20 coastal countries. Each country is competing against each other for limited resources. Nature and human-made disasters have raised serious concerns as we have done from Japan, a major earthquake and tsunami plus a nuclear incident have affected its surrounding neighbors. Continuous global warming might sink Tuvalu and other island countries in the very near future. These problems have threatened Asian lives and properties. The worst is, since the United Nations International Convention on the Sea was adopted in 1982, maritime countries are encouraged to claim sovereignty over as many islands as possible so that their 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone can be run, making neighboring countries conflict with each other. After World War II, with the surrender of Japan in 1945, the United Nations developed plans for a trustee administration of the Korea Peninsula, the North and the South. In June 1950, North Korea invaded the South under the support of Soviet and Chinese communists. During the war, more than 1 million people died, and 3 years fighting throughout the nation effectively destroyed most of the cities. On July 27 of 1953, an armistice agreement was signed. For over a half century, the Korean Peninsula was in a relatively peaceful situation. When President Kim Jong-un became the new head of North Korea last year, international society expected him to be a more rational and predictable leader. Less than 1 year, the young communist leader impressed the world with his incredible and unpredictable character, making the peninsula world's most dangerous ammunition depot. On March 30, North Korea announced to enter a state of war. Ever since then, the war is in any minute to be triggered. The 60 years peace based on amnesty is all of a sudden broken. Who is to blame for it? And who can bring peace back to Korea? It's a breathtaking issue now. Now I'd like to take a look at marine dispute. Japan, China, Taiwan, and even Korea and Russia all either claimed certain disputed islands or had a difficult time diminishing EEZ and continental shelf with neighboring countries. Japan and Korea both claimed sovereignty over Nankot Dock. Japan also has a dispute with Russia over the sovereignty of Northern Territories. Although there is no immediate chance of an outburst of war, the sovereignty dispute will always be a potential cause of conflict between those countries. The most intense situation last month was in the East China Sea, or so-called Senkaku Island, or Diaoyutai in Chinese. The Diaoyutai Island, please take a look at my PowerPoint. The Diaoyutai Island included 8 uninhabited islands located in the East China Sea. They are approximately 100 nautical miles northeast of Taiwan, 200 nautical miles east of Chinese mainland, 230 nautical miles west of Okinawa, and 400 nautical miles south of Japan. Japan, China, and Taiwan each claim sovereignty over the island. Although uninhabited, this island was discovered and named by the Chinese back in the 14th century. This island has been seen as pretending island of Taiwan and traditional fishing ground for Taiwanese fishermen for generations. Geologically, this island and natural prolongation of Taiwan's territory. The Diaoyi Tais are made up of igneous rocks, and their chemical and geographical characteristics are the same as Taiwan's mountain Datun, Datunsan, Jilongyu, Huapingyu. It is the natural prolongation of Taiwan's territory for sure, divided by Okinawa Chao with the Ryukyu Island, which belong to Kirishima volcano systems. Despite knowing that, Chinese discovered and named the island. Japan claims that this island was no one than Terra Nullius. Thus, in their cabinet conference on January 14 of 1895, they secretly annexed the island to the Japanese territory without notifying the world. When China and Japan signed the Treaty of Shimonoseki 3 months later, Diaoyi Tai Island did not appear on the articles and maps. According to public international law, the occupation of a terra nullius must be declared publicly without any country's objection. Thus, Japan's secret and illegal occupation of the Diaoyi Tais was therefore invaded. In 1941, the Tokyo District Court even verdicted that Diaoyi Tai Island belonged to Taipei, not to Okinawa. In 1943, at Cairo Conference, President Franklin Roosevelt inquired Commander Chiang Kai-shek twice about returning Okinawa to China, but Chiang, for some reason, refused the proposal. After World War II, the Diaoyi Tai Island were under United States trusteeship until they were transferred to Japan in 1972. But the United States only transferred the administration right, not the sovereignty. Since then, Japan has administered this island, but the sovereignty issue is still disputed. Situation began to deteriorate in 2012. On September 11, the Japanese government officially nationalized this island. And on December 13, Japan scrambled 8 fighter jets after Chinese maritime plane entered its airspace over the Diaoyi Tais. This is the first air-sea battle phase of between both nations, a sign of China's aggressive attitude toward the Diaoyi Tais under its new leader Xi Jinping. The distance between 2 jet fighters of China and Japan was just 3 miles only. Then on January 31st, the naval fleet of both countries remained only 1 mile distant. The crisis of the war was breathtaking. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe talked tough regarding the issue that the Senkaku group is Japanese territory. On this point, there's no room for negotiation. Now, the world's most powerful nations, China and Japan, have their eyes on the Diaoyi Tais, just like tough guys standing by the gate of Taiwan, 100 miles away, and ready to kidnap her daughter. Can Taiwan close eyes and pretend nothing is happening? President Ma Ying-jeou asserted that Taiwan will not cooperate with China over this dispute, and he proposed a peace initiative for cooperative development in the East China Sea. Despite the fact that Diaoyutai Island geologically are the natural prolongation of Taiwan and historically an inherited territory of Taiwan, I would like to initiate that the Diaoyutai be demilitarized and the marine conservation zone be preserved as the following. Number one, all armed forces withdraw from 12 nautical miles of the island so as to restore peace and stability in the area. Second, no territorial sovereignty claims shall be allowed to undermine the stability and peace in the area. Third, military and nuclear activities that might threaten peace and stability are not allowed to be conducted in this area. Fourth, preserve the Diaoyutai as an international marine conservation zone exclusively for peaceful purpose only. My peace initiative differs from President Ma's proposal that while President Ma emphasized a joint effort to develop the area, my position is rather not to develop. Preserve the area safe for our next generation. It was based on three successful international practices that have solved dispute and conserved nature resources. The first one is 1959 Antarctic Treaty, which was signed up with 12 nations and now currently have 50 nations to join it. Thanks to the Antarctic Treaty, it set aside Antarctic as a scientific preserve, established liberty of scientific investigation, and banned military and nuclear activity on that continent. The main objective is to ensure the interest of all humankind to utilize the continent exclusively for peaceful purpose and to forbid any measures of military nature. Thanks to it, the Antarctica has been preserved for sustainable development. The second one is the 1971 Ramsar Convention on Wetland. The convention is an intergovernmental treaty that provides the framework for national action and international cooperation for the conservation and wise use of wetland and their resources. The third one is the 1994 Dead Sea Marine Peace Park between Jordan and Israel. Israel and Jordan share 41 kilometers of shoreline around the northern Gulf of Aqaba, a semi-enclosed sea with unique natural resources, especially the coral reef ecosystem. Thanks to the Marine Peace Park Treaty, two rival countries successfully cooperate in disputed area. I firmly believe that this initiative is the best and only way to cease the tension and to avoid an outburst of a military conflict with nuclear threat in the East China Sea. It also instrumental for the settlement in the South China Sea and many other potential marine disputes. For the sake of world peace, of regional stability and prosperity, Moreover, for the substantial development of the Pacific Ocean, please join me to launch this campaign to assure the permanent peace for the Pacific. Before I conclude, I'd like to take some time to discuss with you the current and the future developed between Taiwan and China. Talking about the future developed between Taiwan and China, a brief historical reflection is necessary. China has always boasted to the world that Taiwan is an inherited territory of China. The fact was that not until 1887 did China declare Taiwan one of their provinces. But 8 years later, China ceded Taiwan to Japan in perpetuity under the Treaty of Shimonoseki. Japan colonized Taiwan for 50 years till 1945 when Japan surrendered to the Allied forces. In 1949, Mao Zedong overthrew Chiang Kai-shek's Republic of China and established the Communist Regime People's Republic of China, PRC. Chiang Kai-shek and his troops retreated from mainland China to Taiwan and began to rule under martial law till 1987. In 1971, PRC succeeded in expelling ROC from the United Nations, making Taiwan the only nation on Earth without a United Nations membership. Despite its literary claim on the sovereignty of Taiwan, the fact was Taiwan has never exercised its jurisdiction over Taiwan on any single day. Following decades of hard struggle for democracy, Taiwanese people were finally allowed to elect their president directly in 1996. For the first time ever in the history of Taiwan. In 2000, the first native party, DPP, Democrat Pacific Party, won the second general election and peacefully overturned the 50-year one-party nationalist regime. DPP's platform, One Taiwan, One China, was carried out throughout the entire administration by President Chen Shui-bian and me. To respond, the PRC's National People's Congress passed the anti-secession law in 2005. It stipulated that One China passed the was the framework for the peaceful development across the strait toward peaceful unification. Under One China policy, the law designated a series of approaches for the peaceful development stage by stage on one hand. On the other hand, it also legitimized the PRC to take use of force against any kind of secession of national territory from the motherland, referring to the independence of Taiwan. The tension across the strait was thus lifted till 2008 when President Ma Ying-jeou took office. He announced the three no's to maintain the cross-strait relations, namely, no unification, no independence, and no war during his tenure of presidency. He reiterated the three no's in his second inauguration in 2012 again. What do his three no's truly mean? The fact remains, Taiwan has been independent since 1996, when Taiwanese people were allowed to elect their president quadrennially. Otherwise, Why bother? Taiwan hold a general presidential election every 4 years. And how can Mr. Ma elect a president of Taiwan if Taiwan were not an independent country? Speaking of unification, all the policies regarding cross-strait relations implemented by Ma's administration echoes the music of Beijing. For the past 4.5 years, President Ma and Hu Jintao danced the peaceful developed tango with each other to foster peaceful unification. As a matter of fact, China has been annexing Taiwan into its sovereignty silently and effectively with the following strategies: national identity elimination, diplomatic downgrading, economic dependency, military weakening, and cultural confusion. To eliminate Taiwan's national identity and to downgrade Taiwan's international status is PRC's top strategy. They never address the name of Republic of China, ROC, nor any official title of any Taiwanese officials. Even President Ma Ying-jeou himself is called Mr. Ma, Ma Xianzheng. Don't mention to allow Taiwan to join in any international organization without their consent. PRC makes every effort possible to change the name ROC or Taiwan into Taiwan Province of China, or at least Chinese Taipei, nearly on any occasion internationally, misleading the entire world to believe that Taiwan has become a province of China. The Ma's administration entered the Economic Cooperation Framework in 2010, ECFA, a quasi-free trade agreement signed by Taiwan and China. The agreement is not a state-to-state agreement, but one of region-to-region. According to PRC's statistics, as of the end of 2012, the trade between both sides has totaled to an amount of $153.9 billion, of which Taiwan has a surplus of $86.9 billion. In terms of investment, last year, China received $2.85 billion from Taiwanese businessmen, a 30.4% increase compared to previous year. Statistics indicate that ECFA has succeeded in luring Taiwan into China's market, making Taiwan more dependent on China economically. Once China stopped giving way to Taiwan, disaster would come. Taking tourists as a good example, 4.83 million Chinese group tourists have visited Taiwan with a total of 1.8 billion of revenues. Last year, the number of Chinese tourists increased remarkably to 2.58 million. Simply because the year before was Taiwan's presidential campaign year, the PRC did not want their people to come to Taiwan to learn democracy. So they controlled the number of tourists to come, making Taiwan's tourism industry a big recess in 2011. China, being the country owning the largest amount of foreign reserves, has figured out that it is easier and cheaper to buy up Taiwan with money and other strategy rather than using military forces or by political operation. They bribe high-ranking retired officials and generals and lure them to defect to China by hosting in Beijing in high profile, allowing them the privilege of making profit out of trade or investment. They also buy luxurious mansions and office buildings in major cities in Taiwan, including part of Taipei 101. Through some Taiwanese businessmen. It is believed that some media in Taiwan may also have been controlled by China indirectly. The worst part is soon to come. Beginning on February 6, 46 Taiwanese banks across the island were allowed to offer renminbi transaction service to local residents. The first day of the service, the deposit of renminbi currency in Taiwan amounted to 1.3 billion, or $209 million, just in one day. Following the transaction service of new Taiwan currency and renminbi, the economy and finance of Taiwan will be integrated with China, and Taiwan's economy will be rapidly absorbed into China. As a result, China will control and annex Taiwan without one bullet. As the anti-secession law legitimates the use of force against Taiwan, not giving up to invade Taiwan with force has been China's bottom line. The military strength of Taiwan and China used to be balanced, but the latter has far prevailed the former since 2001. PRC's average annual economic growth is over 8%, and the defense budget was increased over 2 digits. In order to prevent the United States military involvement in Taiwan Strait, the People's Liberation Army is strengthening their anti-access area denial ability to break through the first island chain, including taking over the Diaoyutai. Their first aircraft carrier, Liaoninghao, has become a threat to the marine lifeline of Asian countries, especially to Taiwan. Moreover, PRC's new leader Xi Jinping exposes their nuclear strategic power and stressed on the informatization of the PLA. Their Dongfeng 31A and Dongfeng 41 continental missiles can reach as far as any part of the United States. As secretive Chinese military unit is believed to be behind a series of hacking attacks. In the world, PRC's military development has gone beyond their self-defense and become a threat to undermine the regional stability and security. PRC has been successful in seducing retired military generals and intelligence personnel to relocate, making it a great leakage of classified information. They also seduced retired diplomats and cultural, educational, and even religious personnel into visiting China. By doing so, they are paving way for confidence-building mechanism, cultural agreement, and eventually peace agreement for unification. During DPP's administration, President Chen and me and I worked very hard to preserve Taiwanese history and culture and to deepen Taiwanese identity, distinguish it from China and the Chinese. On the contrary, President Ma stressed on Chinese culture and history. He integrated Taiwan with China, not just economically, but also culturally and educationally. He encourages frequent exchange of people, culture, and religions. He accepts the degrees granted by 38 universities in China.
He even allowed Chinese students to stay and work after graduation in Taiwan. PRC low-ranking governmental officials are highly regarded and received in Taiwan. Some of them come frequently and travel across the whole island, meeting with as many people as possible, talking like as the best relatives of Taiwanese or even an official. In their term, they are coming to sell the idea of peaceful unification to the island, to the household, and to the brand. Surprisingly, however, new President Xi Jinping embarrassed President Ma Ying-jeou most recently on three separate occasions. First, China protested against Japan's invitation of Taiwan's Ambassador Chen to attend the second anniversary of the March 11 disaster in Japan. China boycotted. And 3 days later, PRC's Foreign Affairs Ministry publicly urged the Vatican to cut off diplomatic tie with ROC. It was so repeated when President Ma showed up in person to attend the new Pope's inauguration in the Vatican City. And in late March, under pressure from China, Indonesia government notified Taiwanese scholars who had been invited to attend an international defense affairs dialogue to come. Why does China embarrass Taiwan so frequently and ruthlessly? Is Xi Jinping anxious to push Ma to the negotiation table for political talk so that issues such as confidence building mechanism and peace agreement can be entered quickly? The former director of American Institute in Taiwan, Dr. Richard Bush, in his book, The Uncharted Strait, warns that China's patience is limited and Taiwan might have to accept an offer it cannot refuse. I wish his warning is loud enough to wake up those who are in favor or who encourage Taiwan to establish further peaceful development with China. President Xi Jinping made his first statement regarding foreign policy at PRC's Political Bureau of Central Committee in late January. He stressed on the core national interests, which include territory, sovereignty, security, stability, and development. He stressed that China would never make any concession on those core interests. He also spoke to the military that to enrich the country and to empower the army, 富国强兵, are their Chinese dream, a dream to construct China to become a big brother. Reflecting back to the spring of 2007, when United States Pacific Commander Admiral Tim Keating visited Beijing, a PRC military official offered him a proposal, letting the Pacific Ocean be divided from Hawaii and co-managed by China and America on either side, each side. The policy of co-management of Pacific apparently has become part of China's dream of big power. Imagine that a dragon flies from the west and an eagle from the east over the Pacific Ocean. Are they singing and dancing, or are they fighting when they encounter? Being the first United States president to be born and grew up in Pacific, President Obama started his first term by turning his attention from Afghanistan and Iraq to the Western Pacific, trying to enforce a pivot to Asia policy and a rebalancing strategy to Asia. This will need to draw a diamond shape from Okinawa through Guam, Taiwan, and Darwin in Australia. As one of the vertexes of the diamond, Taiwan's strategic role is crucial to the United States. What is the role of Taiwan in Obama's Asia policy? Shortly after the pivot to Asia policy was announced, President Ma received a briefing from AIT, Ma's second inauguration. On Ma's second inauguration, former White House Chief of Staff William Dadi stated to him that America wishes to continue bilateral cooperation in economic, political, and security issues. Taiwan is a partner to the United States. Why? Geologically and strategically, Taiwan is located in the first island chain, where the U.S. trips to strengthen the first island, island chain, China has breached the chain. Owning Taiwan, China's naval ships and aircraft can have free access to the Pacific Ocean and directly challenge the U.S.-Japan alliance. On the contrary, if Taiwan aligns with the U.S., the East China Sea and Bohai will be besieged and China's coastal cities will face missile threat. Taiwan's geological position is important to both China and the U.S. It plays a key role in regional security and economic development. If Taiwan and China start political talks and finally agree on signing confidence-building measures and peace agreement under the One China framework, the cross-strait relations will be downgraded to quasi-internal. China will breach the first island chain and internalize the East China Sea, South China Sea, and the Taiwan Strait. This will counter America's containment and further change the balance of power in the Asia-Pacific. Politically, Taiwan is the lighthouse of liberty and success in Asia. It's unique, developed in human rights, democracy, peace, love, and high tech, elaborate the strength of soft power. Taiwan has created and enriched those universal values to enlighten people living in a communist regime. Integrating Taiwan with democracy will consolidate the threat to defend and develop the Asia-Pacific. The United Nations proclaimed the millennium year of 2000 to be the International Year for the Culture of Peace. It has also designated the following 10 years to be the international decade for a culture of peace. UN's hope is that peoples and government in the world will work together to change the culture of war and violence to that of peace and nonviolence. 12 years have been passed since 2000. Did the UN succeed in promoting the culture of peace? Why did the world fail in seeking and maintaining peace? That's because the orthodox of hard power prevails soft power. During my 8 years vice president and up till today, I've been advocating the philosophy of soft power, referring to Taiwan's democracy, human rights, love, peace, and technological innovation as a good example. These are values and achievements that made Taiwan to transform from a small and poor country under an authoritarian regime into a highly developed country with a full-fledged democracy through a peaceful process. originally defined by Professor Joseph Nye from Harvard, soft power is different from traditional hard power used to measure a country's strength, namely economic and military strength. What we have learned from history is that civilization focused only on hard power will create more chaos, disaster, degradation of disaster. Such an unbalanced approach has created much exploitation and invasion. Contrary to the destructive and exploitative nature of hard power, soft power is constructive and generous in nature. The struggle for hard power is often a zero or even negative sum game, while developmental and sharing nature of soft power is always a positive sum game. Hard power should no longer be the sole measurement of a country's success, and soft power should play a more important role in the future. Based on my philosophy, I have developed a platform for the best future for Taiwan and China. I firmly believe that Taiwan and China should keep a harmonious relationship on the basis of distant relatives and next-door neighbors. Historically, most of our ancestors came from China 100 years ago, and some retreated to Taiwan with KMT in the late 1940s. That's why we are distant relatives. Geographically, Taiwan and China are divided by the strait. Therefore, we are neighbors. Because of that, Taiwanese and Chinese people should not be hostile to each other, nor mission to fight against each other. I propose a new formula to deal with China, 3 C's + 1. The first C is coexistence. Both countries should exist with mutual respect. Second C is cooperation. Division of labor and production of both sides are good for industrial development. And third C is called prosperity in human and cultural perspectives. Taiwan is part of the Chinese culture influenced area and preserve the most exquisite part of the culture. All these 3 C, coexistence, cooperation, and co-prosperity, end up a larger C, constructive engagement. Both countries should engage and cooperate more constructively rather than destructive. It is easier to trigger a war, but much harder to end it. War cannot solve problems, but causes more problems. As Aristotle taught us, it is not enough to win a war. It is more important to organize the peace. If my peace initiative succeeded, it should be able to be applied to other disputed areas as other than the East China Sea. Only then the perspective for the Asia-Pacific will be going toward the bright side. Ladies and gentlemen, it is our common duty to keep Asia-Pacific toward the right track. America surely is a heavyweight player, but Taiwan can also construct to it. My peace initiative could be a good starting point. Please join me in the preventive war and the organization of peace in this area. Thank you.
We still have time for questions. So please, when you ask your question, first of all, say who, identify yourself. Make sure to press the green button on your microphone. And try to keep it as one question or short questions. Thank you. Here first.
Thank you, sir. Akira Chiba from Japan. The China Daily of mainland China posted an ad in the Washington Post last year concerning the islands issue mentioned, and the ad suggested that Taiwan is not part of China, And I found that ad to be very, very interesting. But my question is a hypothetical one. Suppose Japan agreed to Taiwan's standpoint and handed the islands over to Taiwan, how do you think the mainland will react? Will it congratulate the Republic of China for recovering territory, or will it just send PLA naval vessels and take it from Taiwan? In which case, how do you propose to defend these islands?
So I'm not quite sure. Yeah. Your question, could you just briefly, your question?
If Japan gave the islands to Taiwan, would China congratulate Taiwan, or would they be unhappy?
Well, the fact is that 4 days before today, Japan government entered an agreement on fishery rights with Taiwan after 17 years negotiation. Japan still claim their sovereignty on the Diaoyu Tais, but Japan agrees Taiwanese fishermen to have free access beyond 12 nautical miles of the island. According to the media, that PRC anger at that. Not because Japan surrendered to Taiwan, rather because Japan didn't bring the issue to China. The agreement was not made with the consent or negotiation with Beijing. It's very ironic.
Garrett, did you have Garrett?
Vice President Liu, Garrett Vandervee is from the Formosan Association for Public Affairs. You told us in your speech how you feel President Ma is undermining sovereignty of Taiwan. How do you propose to counter this and steer Taiwan back in the right direction and make Taiwan a full and equal member in the international community? What would your policy be?
Well, I would say I'm not accusing President Ma. I just want to draw everybody's attention about the effect of implementing of the 2005 anti-secession law under the term of peaceful development. For the sake of Taiwan, to safeguard the fundamental right of Taiwanese people, certainly it's time for us to draw our attention about the silent effect of the recent development, especially our best friend in Washington, D.C. Don't encourage further peaceful development with a final goal for unification. Secondly, certainly being the major opposition party, DPP, should make it clear also to the people inside that don't rely on China economically too much. It's time for the citizen to reconsider which is more urgent importance, the national security, the national destiny, or business interest. The critical moment is coming.
Listen here.
I saw many hands.
Yeah.
Dear Mr. Liu, thanks for your speech. I'm a student from mainland China, and I have a question for you that in the past 5 years, we have seen that the cross-strait relations is dominated by the KMT government. So my question is that how do you think the DPP and the Pan-Green Coalition can contribute to the cross-strait development and how they can reach out to the government and people in mainland China? Thanks.
First of all, I think the DPP's main job is to elaborate the connotation and the principle of Taiwan Chengdu Jiewen Proclaim in 1999 instead of 1991's Taidu Danggang. According to Taiwan Chengdu Jiewen, Taiwan 是一个主权独立的国家, Taiwan has been an independent sovereignty under the name of Republic of China. Any change of the status quo is subject to the referendum by Taiwanese people. I think this is very fundamental position of DPP. Elaborating it as much as possible, that number one, that Taiwan has been independent. Taiwan has been an independent sovereignty. And second, any challenge of status quo shall be subject to the referendum by the people on Taiwan. We don't have to emphasize anymore about when are we going to declare independence. Not necessary at all, because we have been independent since 1996. But the point is more than that. To remain Taiwan independent from China doesn't mean to confront with China. As my proposal, the best on we are relatives and neighbors. So we can, based on the fact that Taiwan has been independent, that we should cooperate, we should coexist, and we should constructively engage with each other.
Thank you. So first of all, I have a question for you. So what do you think is the reason that make you so dedicated for your career, including your earlier career in the democratization and your recent ambition to improve the environmental and the female rights in Taiwan? So what's the reason make you so dedicated for that? My second question related to your three initiatives. And because both sides from the mainland China, Taiwan, want to do some political talks, including the former Xu Xinliang and Frank Xie Changting wants to do some political talks. Maybe they cannot make any agreements between them. But so would your peace initiative have some like proposal to talk with the mainland China? Thank you.
Two questions. Okay. First one, I was born a fighter. I was born a pioneer. So I devote myself to what I believe is urgently important. So I started the women's movement as the first, because I realized how population of Taiwan women suffered for too long, for too much. So I started to emancipate them. And later I realized autocracy under KMT's martial law regime was totally unjust. So I joined them to fight. And I was jailed for 12 years. I was sentenced to 12 years. And after I resigned, I finished my 8 years vice president. I realized the earth is in urgent crisis. So I devoted myself to rescue the earth, to concern about environmental issues, including I launched the first referendum to prevent the nuclear power plant from installation. So, and this time, my attention is drawn to the world peace, especially the future relationship between Taiwan and China. And your first question, your second question is?
About the political talks between the two sides.
Well, now the point is, who should talk? Who should represent Taiwan to talk? President Ma was elected on January 14 of last year. Unfortunately, within a month, his popularity dropped, and it has maintained long below 13% of people's trust. So who should represent Taiwan to talk is the major question. Unless a national consensus regarding to China policy, it's well democratically formed. It's not a time for further discussion.
Okay.
We're actually up at the end of our time. We're going to take a couple more questions. So there.
Thank you for your speech. I actually have a question regarding to the peace initiatives that you mentioned just now. You mentioned that people should keep the resources for the future generation, but it seems the conflicts will be rose again if the future generation want to use it. So is this a way for you to take the responsibilities away? Thank you.
Thank you. Starting from the beginning of this year, I had many occasions internationally and nationally to widely publicize my ideas, including this special trip to the state. I spent 4 days in Seattle, 4 days in New York before I arrived here. And I was very much impressed by the positive responses from those who have chance to hear from my comment. And in particular, while I was talking in New York, good news came to us that Japan agree to sign up a fishery right agreement, and it provided that the Taiwanese fishermen are free to access beyond 12 nautical miles from the island, pretty close to my peace initiative, not save that area for marine conservation. Certainly, I hope more support and close attention can be run by government, intergovernment, and even international bodies so that eventually a peace treaty can be signed among China, Japan, and Taiwan. I know it may be a long way to go, but after this trip, I'm thinking to call on an international conference to invite the scholars representative from China, Japan, and the state to meet together.
Just one more question back there.
Okay, I'm a student from University of Maryland. First, I'd like to thank for your inspiring and encouraging speech. And I have a question on economic interdependence. As you mentioned that Taiwan is a strategic partner to USA in trading and military and technology, but on the other hand, China and USA are having an increasing share in trading, both in terms of percentage and in absolute amount. So I would like to ask, do you think it is a threat to the three-parts relation because of the increasing economic interdependence? Thank you.
Well, I emphasized in my speech earlier that the increasing dependence on Taiwan's economy on China market will put Taiwan in a very dangerous situation. The world is so big, we should encourage more Taiwanese to have their business and investment on the other part of the world instead of.
I think we've had some very wonderful comments today. I think, first of all, we see Vice President Liu's great love of Taiwan. Secondly, I think in her peace initiative, we see both her longstanding interest in peace, and number two, her real strong concern also for environmental issues. And this gives her peace initiative a very special flavor than we see in other proposals. So I have you all join me in thanking Vice President Liu for her comments today.